This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 9th. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll check in with Ethan Genter of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Gratzide of Nantucket Current. CAI's Gilda Geist will speak with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Wind energy made national news twice this week. On Monday, the Supreme Court issued an order on two legal challenges to Vineyard Wind. The same day, Massachusetts and a group of other states filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over the president's executive order on wind. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to talk about all the wind news. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. Two cases brought by commercial fishing interests have been making their way through the court system. Both say the federal approval of Vineyard Wind, the offshore wind farm currently under construction south of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, violated proper procedure and environmental law. But the court's action was pretty straightforward. Tell us about that.
Yes. The Supreme Court order in both of these cases was a denial of their petition, which really what that means is the court is declining to take up the cases. And they were consolidated as well. So they're essentially one case. They were consolidated in a lower court. But not taking up a case is very common. It is what happens with the vast majority of cases that are seeking a review before the Supreme Court. So for these cases contesting the approval of Vineyard Wind, it means the lower court decisions stand. And the appeals court said that the plaintiffs here, primarily these fishing companies, could not establish that the approval of Vineyard Wind failed to comply with a list of several different environmental laws they were asserting there. Those include the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act.
These cases were specifically about Vineyard Wind, which, as we say, is being built about 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. We know some local fishers supported these lawsuits. Tell us about the plaintiffs. Who was involved in the case?
Yes, one case was filed by an advocacy group called the Responsible Offshore Development Alliance. That group has members who are fishing companies and individual vessels as well. And many, many of those vessels are local. They're the members of that group include about 50 fishing vessels that are home ported in New Bedford or Fairhaven, plus other vessels from Cape Cod and the Vineyard. Then in the other case, the plaintiffs, again, are several fishing businesses and associations. Some are from Massachusetts. One I would note is Sector 13. Sector 13 is a designation for certain ground fish license holders on the East Coast. So they are involved. There are some local members of that. And that second case had legal representation from a notable group, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which, among other things, supports the oil and gas industry. As we said, those two cases are very closely related. Not only were they consolidated, but some members of a group, for example, Sector 13, which is a plaintiff in one, that group is a member of ROTA, the plaintiff in the other lawsuit. So they're closely related.
So overall, this looks like a legal victory for Vineyard Wind. But there's more. Now the states that support wind energy more broadly are suing the Trump administration. Remind us a little bit about the executive order that they're pushing back on here.
Sure. So if you recall, President Trump during the campaign had promised to do something about offshore wind on day one, and he did. He issued an executive order that basically put a stop to all permitting and approval of wind energy projects. And it was not just for offshore wind. It includes onshore wind as well, which is interesting because some of the states that are the most heavily into onshore wind are Republican-dominated states. So all of those ones that are not fully permitted are on hold.
What's the case that they're trying to make as they push back on this?
Yeah, briefly, they're suing President Trump and all the agencies that are involved in permitting wind farms. They're saying those actions are arbitrary and based on an inconsistency with other federal policy that goes unexplained and they're saying is therefore illegal.
How about the Trump administration? They weigh in here. What do they have to say about how this is played out?
Yes, I did ask some questions of the White House press office, and a spokesperson there, Taylor Rogers, responded to my questions by email. She said that the Democrats are engaging in lawfare, that is, using legal procedure as a weapon to try to stop President Trump's energy agenda. And she said they could be working with him instead to, quote, lower energy prices. She also said the Democrats' goals are a radical climate agenda.
You got some reaction to this this week from a wind supporter on Cape Cod who teaches courses in renewable energy. It's some interesting things to say. Share some of that response.
Yes, I talked with Chris Powicki, who has taught renewable energy courses at Cape Cod Community College, and he is the Cape and Islands chair for the Sierra Club, which supports wind energy. He says that one interesting thing about the lawsuit is there may be some red states that could very well want this lawsuit to succeed because they, again, have such a big investment in wind farms on land. But he does not think they will be speaking up about it because of the politics. And then the other issue that he raised, is that if the states do win an injunction in this case that would block the executive order, there are other ways that the Trump administration could kind of work around it or delay permitting of wind farms.
So this lawsuit, not likely the end, as we might expect.
Right, yes.
CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Since President Trump took office, more than a quarter of the staff at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center are no longer with the agency. CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Gilda Geist worked together to report this story. Eve Zuckoff joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start by breaking down that number, the quarter that are no longer with the agency, because we have to explain it. NOAA is a complicated agency, and not everyone may be familiar with the fisheries.
Yeah, so who makes up this 27% where they work? Because, as you said, the New England Fisheries Science Center has five offices, one in Woods Hole, one in Rhode Island, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Maine. And it's not clear how many of the departed staff worked in each of these offices, specifically Woods Hole we were curious about, which is described as the focal point also for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center's operations, management, and information needs. But we know a large part of the 27% reduction in staff includes people who took an early retirement or their so-called voluntary separations after kind of having their hands forced to do so in some ways by Trump appointees. It also includes individuals who were let go as so-called probationary employees. These include new hires or employees who have moved into a new role.
Last week on this show, you actually mentioned that you've been trying to verify the number of people who've lost their jobs at NOAA or who are gone as a result of the administration policies. Tell us about some of your reporting here, how you and Gilda Geist worked to get this 27% figure, 27% of employees now gone.
Yeah, so we got this number initially from a current NOAA employee who asked not to be named for this story for fear of retaliation. And then when we tried to verify it with Terry Frady, Chief Research Communications Officer for the New England Fisheries Science Center, she told us that her last day in the federal service was April 30th. So she is among those who have left. So, you know, we apply a rigorous standard to report numbers out, especially when it, you know, comes to the government and something that has real teeth and importance. It has been very difficult to follow our typical channels under this administration, which is why we sought actually emails and we got multiple people to verify that 27% reduction in staff. So we have both former and current NOAA employees who helped us make sure that this is accurate.
Related to this, Eve, you reported this week that the Marine Mammal Commission, which is an independent government agency, could be eliminated by the Trump administration. First, tell us more about what they do and what's at stake here.
Sure. So the Marine Mammal Commission was created more than 50 years ago to ensure the Marine Mammal Protection Act is followed and also to provide like independent science-based oversight of federal activities or programs that could affect, you know, whales and dolphins and seals. So things things happening in the ocean that the federal government is doing that might have some impacts. This is where the Marine Mammal Commission steps in. That is their only job. And the Trump administration's budget proposal basically laid out plans to eliminate the commission in fiscal year 2026. That was shared with Congress last week. And as we've been talking about, the news follows this trend by the Trump administration to gut federal programs and staff that work in climate and environment fields. So it is yet another cut.
You have been reporting on whales in our waters for a long time. You have a lot of, you know, a lot of people in this field. What kinds of reactions did you hear to this potential elimination?
Yeah, well, I heard there was a letter released, first of all, by the chair of the commission, Frances Gulland, and she said, "I regret having to share this news and my concern about the impact this proposal would have on marine mammals, the American public, and especially our marine and coastal communities." Went Jane Davenport. She's a senior attorney with the advocacy group Defenders of Wildlife. She just called this shameful and disappointing. It's an attack on conservation. And she said, you know, we have to remember that, like, healthy ocean ecosystems, especially here in our region, but all over the country, are essential for healthy fisheries and coastal tourism and recreation. Meanwhile, the commission has an annual operating budget of $4.5 million a year, which comes to just over one penny per American per year. So Davenport said she couldn't share whether Defenders of Wildlife would take legal action if the commission is undermined, but she said it's a bridge that we will cross if we get there.
Okay, let's talk about one other story that you've been covering. After facing sudden closure this winter, the Pocasset Mental Health Center could soon be getting a financial boost. This was a really big story for our local region through the early part of the year. Give us the background here and what the latest is.
Yeah, so Governor Mara Healey in January in her fiscal 2026 proposed budget laid out plans to close the state's Pocasset Mental Health Center. And it's a 16-bed inpatient acute mental health stabilization unit that serves patients 19 and older. It's one of just two inpatient psychiatric facilities on the Cape. So without it, there would be less than two dozen inpatient mental health beds to serve the region. Everyone else, and a lot of people do this, end up in emergency rooms for long periods. And then when people heard about this, there was an about face. Healey said her initial plans to close the facility, actually along with the Canton-based Pappas Rehabilitation Hospital for Children, changed after hearing just overwhelming feedback from patients and families and staff who said, "You cannot do this. We need more resources for mental health across the Cape Coast and Islands, not less." So that brings us up to most recently, when Falmouth Representative David Vieira successfully got his House colleagues to allocate $50,000 to the Pocasset Mental Health Center to open up two additional beds in the facility. He is hoping to get more out of the Senate budget. He's working with the Senate colleagues to have a couple more beds open, and said it's his top priority these days. So it's kind of a little waypoint in this story that we should keep following.
We should keep following. As always, those budget numbers keep changing as they work out the budget on Beacon Hill. Mm. That's CAI's Eve Zukoff, who will be back at the end of the show for one last check-in. That's right. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Eve.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Ethan Genter with the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The U.S. Coast Guard is looking to downsize the number of navigational buoys it maintains, and that includes quite a few among the Cape and Islands, which is raising some opposition among local mariners. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with more details. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
I'm on the water a fair amount. There are some startling numbers here about just how many buoys the Coast Guard has out there in the Northeast. Tell us about the big picture here and what they're proposing.
Yeah, so kind of from New York to Quoddy Head up by the Canadian border, there are about 4,700 buoys, navigational buoys in the water all around the East Coast. And so what the Coast Guard right now is proposing is, you know, one official described it to me as right sizing, kind of getting those down to more what they kind of say is an efficient number. And right now the proposal is to pull 350 buoys from the Northeast.
So 350 overall from the Northeast, but from around our region, they're looking to pull a smaller number, obviously. And in part, this is when you say they're right-sizing, it's because they're also aware that most mariners these days have all kinds of navigation aids already on their boats. They're not just navigating by buoys.
Yeah, the Coast Guard rationale for this is that basically every boat has a GPS or electronic navigation chart, kind of another technological savvy aid here. And like you said, there's about 20 around the vineyard, but they're all over in Buzzards Bay, around Nantucket, on the Cape. We didn't count those because they just weren't much of our concern. But yeah, I mean, they're talking about dozens and dozens. And, you know, this has caused some concern for folks.
Tell us about locally which ones they're targeting in this potential reduction.
Yeah, I mean, around the vineyard, there's one that a lot of people know is the Hooter, which is kind of down south of Chappie, kind of for the noise it bobs up and down the water and makes. There's a bunch around the Elizabeth Islands, and kind of the most concerning for some of the vineyard fishermen that I had talked to were the ones in Woods Hole Harbor and kind of the channel in between Woods Hole and the Elizabeth Islands.
So right now, this is just a plan, and the Coast Guard is what they call, soliciting feedback from mariners. What kinds of things, you reached out to a number of people, what kinds of things did you hear about this?
Yeah, I talked to a few fishermen, and as you can imagine, a lot of them said, hey, the buoys were put here for a reason. I'm not sure we should be taking them out. A lot of people said there's, you know, kind of in the new generation of boaters, there's an over-reliance on kind of GPS and electric navigation, and you know, those things can fail, and if you kind of pull these buoys out, what happens? To be clear, there's still going to be buoys out there for folks, so the Coast Guard is saying these are the ones we deem not as essential as some of the other ones. But yeah, there was a lot of concern. Some harbor masters I had talked to here on the island said, you know, this will probably affect some boaters that are coming to the vineyard. But from kind of their perspective, it doesn't change a whole lot. We'll kind of see how the public comment goes out and kind of how this whole plan rolls along.
I think a lot about boating and boating safely has redundancy built into it. And one of the things that the feedback that you are pointing to here, a lot of people pointing to the idea that, you know, GPS units can fail, your electronics can fail, especially when you're out in the weather and you're in saltwater environments. Having those buoys there is a big part of having that redundancy towards safety.
Yeah, and this plan, a lot of people I reached out to said, I haven't really heard much about that. So it seems like this is kind of starting to slowly roll out. It's been something that Coast Guard has been working on for a few years. I do believe that they have kind of floated a similar idea, and I believe in Chatham a few years ago, and that caused kind of an uproar down there. It's definitely people are kind of saying, you know, well, why did we put it out there in the first place if we didn't think it was a good idea?
So folks can still weigh in. Tell us what the process and the timeline is.
So they'll have until June 13th. You have to email your comments to the Coast Guard. There's no calling or writing snail mail. We have a link to the email on our website, and there's also a map where you can kind of see not just the ones around the vineyard, but the whole East Coast.
That is Ethan Genter with the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read that and find that contact information. Ethan, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Town meeting season continues as Chatham convenes tomorrow. Voters there are facing a lengthy warrant. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle has details. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Ryan, sometimes town meetings seem largely procedural, and then there's the kind of town meeting that Chatham seems to have lined up. There are quite a number of important questions here. The Center for Active Living is once more a topic, and so is the airport. Tell us about what's happening at Chatham Town Meeting.
Yeah, it's certainly no shortage of things to weigh in on and debate tomorrow. 59 articles on the warrant for those interested in attending. It's tomorrow at 11 a.m. at Monomoy Regional Middle School. Yeah, and I would say first and foremost, you know, the Center for Active Living and the discussion around the airport continue to kind of hold center court. amongst all the things going up for debate tomorrow. The Center for Active Living, you know, that's a project that the town has really just been going back and forth and sort of chipping away at for some time. What's different about this request or this proposal, they're looking at $5 million to renovate the existing facility on Stony Hill Road, whereas, you know, previous questions that had gone before voters had proposed, you know, building a whole new building at a much higher cost. Mm-hmm. Also worth noting, this only requires a majority vote to pass, whereas past articles have required a two-thirds majority. That's been a real sticking point in the past. There have been some very close votes that have passed by a simple majority but didn't meet that two-thirds threshold. So I think town officials are hoping that the lower threshold of just a simple majority will help with some traction there.
I'm curious about the airport discussion. There, part of this centers around the idea of limiting who can land at the airport. Is that right? Or banning certain aircraft?
Yeah, that's really kind of the crux of Article 59. It's going to be the last article on the warrant. It's a petition, a citizen petition that, you know, if it passes, would prohibit, you know, aircraft with wingspans greater than 49 feet from using Chatham Municipal Airport. Proponents for the article are kind of coming back to the same, you know, issues that they've argued for in the past, that this will be improve, you know, safety at the airport. It'll curb, you know, issues relating to noise. Opponents to it simply point to the fact that it's not legal. You know, they say that it's only you know, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and MassDOT that can dictate what aircraft can and can't use the airport. So they're saying, you know, even if this passes, there's some legal hurdles that would need to be cleared in order for anything to happen. But yeah, this is sort of just the latest chapter in the ongoing saga surrounding, you know, the airport and its operations.
Ryan, remind us the details about the meeting tomorrow. Where is it and when does it get underway?
Yep, tomorrow, Monomoy Regional Middle School. It starts at 11 a.m. And again, no shortage of things to weigh in on. Those are the particulars for Saturday.
And childcare is available.
Childcare is available. That's a relatively unique option in offering in Chatham. So, you know, sometimes it can be hard for, you know, parents with younger kids to get out and participate in the meeting. But they will have that taken care of. That will be at the school. And so, yeah, that's certainly an option for, you know, parents of young kids that are on the fence about whether or not they can go.
It's Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Ryan, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Sea level rise and increasingly powerful storms from climate change are not just hypothetical environmental threats, not if you're living in Provincetown. The town is drafting a coastal resilience plan. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what's at stake. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Why is this important for Provincetown? What is at stake here that the town needs such a robust coastal resilience plan? Lay this out for us.
As you said in the lead, this is not theoretical. There have already been really significant saltwater intrusions in Provincetown. In 2018, the whole area around Town Hall and another neighborhood in the west end of town had floodwaters 6 to 8 inches deep just rolling across the streets and pooling up to about 3 feet deep in some neighborhoods. So that was really destructive. It happened again in the east end in 2022 in an area around Howland Street. Again, people's basements, the floorboards of people's kitchens all having to be replaced, a lot of electrical work destroyed, you know, really expensive water damage.
So this plan is kind of like a comprehensive look at how the town can respond to these forces. Is that right?
Yes. Instead of taking a scattershot, you know, one thing at a time, they're like, what is this going to look like over decades? And it's a really interesting plan that begins with a lot of stormwater improvements to the drainage systems, you know, turning these outfall pipes that go into the harbor into forced pumped outfalls, and also some improvements to the sewer stations, which turn out to be, there's a lot of them all over town. Some of them are in low-lying areas, and they're a really vulnerable part because of all the electricals involved.
Let me ask you about Commercial Street, which seems to be kind of emblematic for some of what's most challenging here. What are some of the ideas proposed for Commercial Street, which is so low and so exposed?
Right. Commercial goes up and down, sort of, and the low-lying areas can sometimes be just a couple of feet above the high tide line. So in the very long run, there will be raising of those low-lying stretches, 2 feet at first and then eventually 4 feet. But as you do that, it's really difficult for the properties that are, especially the buildings that are very close. You create access issues. There's not a lot of room to add ramps and stairs because Commercial is so tightly packed. You know, you walk down the main district of Provincetown and everything, sometimes buildings are only 2 feet apart. So there's just not room to add a bunch of ramps to things. You also have drainage and runoff issues when you have a street higher than the buildings next to it.
The map that you guys have printed along with this, which I guess comes from the report that shows flood risk downtown is striking just because there's so much red and orange in it all the way down through the center of it. The town is so low in the center of it, built around the harbor. There's been some examination of how to reduce the impact from waves crashing in. I think this is really interesting. Talk about this.
Right. So raising Commercial is a very far off idea. In the much nearer term, the idea is to reinforce a series of bulkheads along with, in some places, dunes and natural sand where the sand is already accumulating because of the movement of the harbor. But in general, the bulkheads that the town has are not going to be high enough. They came up with a number that's about 6 feet above the current high tide line. And all over town, and it's going to be a very expensive project, and they're talking about having the town get easements so that government money, not just property tax money, but also state grants and federal grants, can be used to systematically raise bulkheads about 4 feet above where a lot of them currently are.
And they're talking about ways to, like, wave attenuators. Is this right?
Yes. So also down the line in the east end, because it's more exposed to storms from the south, there's a few different ways you can block wave action and really limit the crashing force. One of them is these giant concrete blocks kind of shaped like triangles that go off, you know, about where the low tide line would be. Another way to do it is there are floating systems. The harbor has a floating attenuator. That's incredibly expensive, so I think not super likely because we're talking about almost a mile long at this point. But that concrete wave attenuator could wind up being a feature of the shoreline as these bulkheads are raised.
You mentioned the costs here, and I think that's a big question. What kind of costs are being projected by this plan, and what's the idea about who's going to pay for this?
I mean, in the near-term cost, you have maybe $5 to $10 million worth of pump stations. That's, you know, groundwater or stormwater pumps. You have another $5 to $10 million worth of improvements to the sewer stations to make sure that they're stronger. When you get farther out, especially when you're trying to use state and federal and property tax money to reinforce the shoreline, those are going to be huge numbers. Even if you get the easements for free, which you can make a case to the property owners that this easement is adding value to your property, it's still going to cost a lot of money to do. So there's a lot of interest in having, you know, there's a state resolving fund that helps with sewer infrastructure. It's 0% interest loans from the state. The select board is saying we're going to need something like that because it won't be only Provincetown. A lot of coastal communities are going to be facing very expensive investments and be needing ways to at least not be paying huge interest rates on those investments.
Mm. So a lot of good information here. You can read all about it in the Provincetown Independent. Paul Benson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Nantucket Town Meeting stretched into 2 days with a day off in between, I guess so people could recover. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has more and joins us. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This town meeting, looking at the coverage, it did feel a little like a bruising heavyweight prize fight. On Saturday, the big issue was funding for the replacement of the senior living facility, R Island Home. This has been a long saga, and ultimately, town meeting balked at the price, which is eye-watering. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, this was a tough one and a very emotional debate that happened on Saturday at town meeting. Nantucket is the only municipality in Massachusetts that runs its own skilled nursing home. Most of these facilities have long since become private. But our island home is operated and owned by the town. And the proposal that the town has been looking at, you know, for over a decade now, is to build a new our island home to replace the sort of aging and inadequate facility that exists now. And the proposal, as it came to town meeting, had been hashed out for a number of years. The town had already spent $8 million designing this building and getting it to the point where they had a final bid on the project. But the price tag, you know, the cost of building on an island is, you know, going to be, you know, some factor higher than the mainland. Doing it in an environment of tariffs and other factors, the cost of construction has gone up. The final bids that came in put it at $125 million. So this would have been the most expensive and largest project the town had ever undertaken. So a lot of the debate on town meeting centered around the, as I said, was emotional. People know and want to have a new facility. They want to take care of the elders in our community. But the price tag was so high that a lot of people had reservations. But ultimately, this vote got a strong majority of people in favor, but because it was a debt exclusion override article, it required a two-thirds majority, which it just missed. So it did have a strong majority in favor, but was not approved at town meeting. And it will still be on the ballot, but of course, to move forward, you need both the ballot vote and the town meeting vote. So people are anticipating and waiting to see what happens at the ballot. If there's a strong majority there, the select board could consider bringing it back at another special town meeting. But for right now, it looks like this project is not moving forward.
On Monday, town meeting took up the issue of short-term rentals. I can't remember a Nantucket town meeting now when this wasn't being discussed, it feels like. Once more, there were proposals for regulating short-term rentals. We're talking about things like Airbnb. And once more, not a single proposal got enough votes to pass, which kind of is like punting in a very a critical way here.
Yeah, this has been, as you mentioned, the topic at every town meeting the island has had since 2021. And it's really, as we described it in the current on our website, has become a stalemate. Some of the easier things regarding, you know, short-term rentals have been approved in the past. We've got a town approved registry. We've banned corporate ownership, but, you know, on Nantucket and many communities are grappling with how to regulate, you know, short-term rentals, cities, small towns, resort areas. The quirk on Nantucket is that, rentals are not specifically, expressly allowed in our zoning code. So what has that you know, factor has created lawsuits where neighbors are suing their neighbors saying they're operating a commercial business in a residential neighborhood that is not allowed. So a lot of the debate over the last 4 years has been let's put these in the zoning code and then regulate them through a general bylaw. On one side, people are hoping that town meeting would approve that. But for the sixth time now, that an effort to do that has been turned down. People believe that if you, you know, put it into the zoning code and allow it in all residential districts, you're going to allow sort of open the floodgates where other folks on the other side of the debate say, you know, we've got to end these lawsuits. We've got to end the sort of legal limbo that the short-term rentals exist in right now on Nantucket. And then you've got another side asking to restrict them even further. And those articles were defeated by an even larger margin than the zoning bylaw, which, again, like the Our Island Home, did receive a strong majority, but again, needed two-thirds to be approved and was ultimately turned down. So we're still at a stalemate.
It's Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thank you.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
This week, the state Senate introduced its version of a budget for the coming fiscal year. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House reporter Katie Lannon about this and other news from Beacon Hill. They started off talking about how the proposed Senate budget compares to this year's budget. Here's their conversation.
They're pitching it as kind of a small increase when you really get down to it. Revenue growth has been slowing down, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to come out of Washington, D.C., But Senate leaders say only a small piece of that is really money they're able to spend on new projects and initiatives, because so much of it is taken up by obligations like the MassHealth insurance program, increased funding for local schools.
How does the Senate's version of the budget compare to the State House's version?
Yeah, that's, I think, where we're going to see some major differences continue to emerge when the Senate takes up this bill later this month and really adds in amendments that reflect priorities of the different members. But some differences we already know about is funding for the MBTA. The House wants to put more money to the T than the Senate does. The Senate's led by its president is from Metro West, and the budget chief is from Westport, and they really focus on regional equity is how they describe it. So they want to put money to regional transit authorities. There's also a proposal in the House budget that would pause the Healey administration's plan to overhaul vocational high school admissions to a lottery system. The Senate isn't going along with that. And they also differ from the House in kind of the specific language on a proposal that would try to make landlords responsible for broker fees and apartment rentals instead of having tenants foot the bill. They both want to do that, but they differ on the specifics.
So the state Senate president, Karen Spilka, announced this week that the Senate will be looking into removing the sales tax on construction materials for multifamily housing projects. So is this in response to Trump's tariffs, the state's lack of affordable housing, or both?
That's right. It's definitely both. It's a tariff-driven idea in part because construction materials are expected, you know, when you think of lumber from Canada and things of that nature, are expected to take a major hit here if these tariffs do go into full effect. But Massachusetts does need to build more housing. That's been true for many years now. So that's why they're looking specifically at multifamily housing to increase density and get projects that are really otherwise ready to go, except for these added costs.
And so what's next for this sales tax idea? Does the Senate have the power to do this on its own?
No, they would really need to get the House and Governor Healey to buy in on this. It is something that a Healey administration task force on housing production has suggested. So that might work out easy with the administration. They might be ready to go on board. But this is something we're going to see proposed. Studying this idea will be proposed as a budget amendment, and it is from Cape Cod Senator Julian Sear. So we'll be watching to see how that advances through the budget process and if the House ultimately agrees there.
That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. An immigration judge in New Hampshire has ordered the release of Juan Francisco Mendez, an immigrant who was arrested in New Bedford last month after a federal agent smashed through his car window to detain him. Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light joins us with the latest. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, Steve. And I just want to say a quick correction. The immigration judge was in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Juan Francisco Mendez is being held in Dover, New Hampshire.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
This case has gotten a lot of attention, especially after the video taken from inside the car by the wife of Mendez. It was posted to social media. What do we know about him right now and his whereabouts right now?
So right now he is in the Stratford County Correctional Facility in Dover, New Hampshire. When the judge declared a failure to prosecute yesterday, that effectively meant he could have been released immediately. That being said, it has not happened yet. There was a emergency motion for immediate release filed in federal court in New Hampshire, and ICE has until this afternoon to respond to that. But as far as we could tell right now, he is still being held in Stratford County detention.
This is kind of extraordinary in so many ways throughout this case, but explain this term you just used, failure to prosecute, because this was key in what happened in the courthouse yesterday.
Oh, absolutely. So when a person is charged with an immigration-related offense, they generally receive a document called a notice to appear, which in immigration, which is a civil matter, is roughly equivalent to a charge in criminal court. Mr. Mendez was detained on April 14th. And according to his lawyer, Undine Snisson, he has yet to be charged with any immigration-related offense. And when the judge saw that, he said, okay, you've had a whole month to prosecute this person, and you have not filed any formal charges. When I was in the courtroom, I heard absolutely no response from the DHS attorney. ICE falls under the Department of Homeland Security. And Undine Snisson called it a recognition of the fact that they violated Mendez's civil rights when they arrested him on the 14th.
And that's his lawyer, Undine Snisson.
Correct.
So in the end, the judge called on the prosecution to lay out their case, and they said nothing, and which is why he declared this a failure to prosecute. There's even some question. I mean, I know that Mendez's lawyer said she hasn't even seen the warrant that he was arrested under. And there's a question whether he was picked up in a case of mistaken identity.
Yeah, and those are all questions that are still up in the air. I have not seen a warrant. His lawyer has not seen a warrant. We're expecting to see some developments today as ICE respond. The U.S. Attorney General's office responds to the emergency petition.
I want to take kind of a step back here and talk about some of what's been happening, particularly on the South Coast, which you and the folks at the New Bedford Light have been doing such a great job covering. I believe there's as many as 18 detainments so far that have happened.
Well, it's at least 22 at this point. And some activists in the city say it's in the 30s, even 40s at this point. But we have confirmed 22. And it started a couple weeks before. It started a couple weeks after President Donald Trump was inaugurated with the Minuteman car wash raid, where three undocumented men were arrested. But it's been going nonstop since then. In late March, people in an apartment in the south end of the city said that ICE agents bursted in with a battering ram wearing military fatigues, did not show a warrant, and detained one of the guardians of the household in front of their very eyes, pointing guns at teenagers. And of course, the most well-known incident is the April 14th incident in which Mr. Mendez was taken in. On Wednesday, there were also four more people detained in operations throughout the city. And it appears to be an ongoing campaign.
An ongoing campaign, which it appears that ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks, they're not about to roll back, that this is only going to step up, most likely, is what it sounds like when you hear them talking about this.
Yeah, it's based on what we've heard from them and based on what I've been seeing. I have no reason to believe that this is going to slow down anytime soon.
The New Bedford has, and the South Coast has, such a strong immigrant communities. The feeling there must be, I can't even imagine, actually, how rattled and terrified people must be feeling.
Yeah, well, I spoke with a woman whose husband was detained on Monday. And she was in a panic for thinking about how am I going to financially maintain this household. You're seeing people who used to be willing to speak to the press all of a sudden pull back. Acushnet Avenue in New Bedford's North End is almost a ghost town at this point. And it used to be a thriving center of Portuguese and Guatemalan businesses. And, you know, it's unclear what the impact of this is going to be, but you can already see with your own eyes that people have noticed.
The immigrant support services there, how are they stepping up to try to support families across the region?
So several nonprofit organizations have formed a mutual aid network. They are offering financial and material support to people That's pretty much all they can really do, offer access to legal services, offer diapers, offer food, access to medical services. But they're getting pretty stretched at this point. So the question is, how will their support for these communities develop? What can they do in response to these operations? And how will these operations evolve?
That is Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light. Kevin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me, Steve.
Since 2019, CAI's Eve Zukoff has been covering environment stories and science stories, and a great deal else, too, across the Cape, the islands, the South Coast. Today marks Eve's last day reporting for CAI. She's moving on. We want to take a few minutes here to acknowledge this and the work that she's done. So welcome back here, Eve Zukoff.
Hi, Steve.
You started before the pandemic. You were hired to be our environment reporter, but you've covered plenty of other stories, including a bank robbery, the voting day when ballots got locked in a vault that wouldn't open, the unannounced arrival of migrants flown to Martha's Vineyard. You've won quite a few awards for your reporting. Hey, we're going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you, too. There's no swearing on the radio. They didn't say anything about crying, though. No, I've been so lucky to talk with hundreds or it might be thousands of people here about how they're seeing this place change and what they're holding on to. I've talked to activists and archivists and veterinarians and veterans and fishermen and migrants and toddlers and old ladies. I've done interviews on sailboats and beaches in hard hats and waders. I've traveled in an army caravan. I've also embedded in a high school cosmetology class here, which was much scarier. I would have been lost without the generosity of our listeners across the region. And I would have been lost without you, Steve, my editor. People may not know that when we're not doing this, we are working together on every single story, and you have been patient and brilliant. You have made me a better writer and person. You've structured stories that I cannot structure. You've made my ear better. You've protected me and everyone else from my worst ideas, and I'm really going to miss working with you.
That's very nice of you to say. You are not leaving reporting. In fact, you're heading up to the big city, and we are likely still to hear your voice occasionally as part of the New England News Collaborative.
That's right. I will be covering breaking news, general assignment, and more for WBUR, Boston's NPR station. The work begins May 27th. A big part of my beat will be Boston City Hall. I will be following the mayoral race very closely.
It's been my pleasure to be your editor through the years. I can attest to your energy and perseverance and your thoroughness and your love for a good story. But mostly, I would point to how much you care. And you care not only about the stories you've covered, but about the people in those stories. I'm thinking about the migrants and the people who work to disentangle whales and the National Guard members that you spoke with and on and on. There's a lot of things that you can teach about journalism and reporting, but I'm not sure that you can teach caring. And thanks for bringing that to our radio each week. It's been great working alongside you.
Thank you, Steve.
Anything else you want to add here?
In our final seconds, maybe my last notes to our listeners. By now, you've all likely heard that public radio is under threat. It's been smeared and hacked at, and yet here you are. And that means so much. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. And please cut me off now.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Thank you for all the good work. Keep doing it wherever you go. We are so excited for your future. Listeners, if you see Eve around in the next week or two, be sure to wish her well. Thanks, Eve.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests, CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we heard from Kevin G. Andrade of the New Bedford Light. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. When they make a calendar of NPR icons, I'm expecting we'll see him on the page for May. That's all we've got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. We'll talk to you next week.